And we are back live on Newsline on WICC with more about the election and parsing the results. And joining us live is Dr. Bilal Siku, Assistant Professor of Political Science, University of Hartford. And good to have you here, Doctor. Thank you so much. So, Donald Trump.
Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you. Always great to have you here on the show. All right. Oh, my goodness. I literally don't know where to start with all of this, but a resounding win for Donald Trump.
Right.
Let's talk about some of the voters who went for him. Male voters. Now, we were wondering if the quote unquote bro vote, whether they would care whether Joe Rogan supported Donald Trump, whether Elon Musk was campaigning for him. You know, you sometimes think, celebrities, it doesn't make a difference at the end. Was it that celebrity appeal, or was it some other reason that younger male voters in particular cast their votes for Donald Trump?
Yeah, it's not altogether clear that celebrity endorsements, and for that matter, even newspaper endorsements, are that persuasive among voters. But I think clearly there has been a trend, and it isn't just this year, but there's been a trend, you know, starting back in 2016, where white males, especially younger white males, were either being activated, people who had not voted in the past, or people who had voted but were being drawn away from the Democrats to Donald Trump. So his portion of the white male population has actually been growing over the years, and so it isn't surprising that he's able to get that kind of support from white males. I think what's interesting this time around, and as the exit data, you know, becomes more and more available, though I will say that polling may go out with the dinosaurs, given how badly they were off in predicting the outcome of this election. But I think looking at what percentage of Latino males, the kind of Latino males, black males, and other males of color supported Trump will be interesting to see. My sense is that number increased as well, though, again, the majority are still probably voting for the Democratic candidate. But when you are able to make an inroad into that community, I mean, that drives up those numbers. And I think that was really important for Trump's success, especially in some of the battleground states. In that sense, yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned the polling, and maybe it will go the way of the dinosaur. I mean, we have had previous afternoons after the election discussing the polls getting it so wrong. I mean, we thought Hillary Clinton was going to win in 2016, and this time it was tied, really, and tied in all of the battlegrounds. But he won handily in all the battlegrounds. I don't know why. I mean, this is probably a topic of conversation for a whole other half hour. But in a nutshell, how could the polls get it so wrong that he didn't have a big lead?
I mean, I think it's really hard to do accurate polling right now. I mean, you call 100 people, maybe 10 people will answer. It's hard to sort of predict who will actually be the likely voters. I mean, there are a lot of people who say they're going to vote, who don't vote, and there are a lot of people who say they're not going to vote, who may end up at the last minute voting. And also, you know, the ability of candidates to activate voters who typically don't vote. I mean, and that certainly has happened with Donald Trump. Barack Obama had some success in doing that when he ran as well. So it's really difficult to figure this out with any real precision. And so we get left. But I think the way they've been off these last few election cycles really suggests that there's something much more systemic that needs to be figured out among pollsters if people are going to really take them seriously.
Yeah. Back to the exit polling, I guess, and, you know, why people voted the way they did and who voted for whom. This really struck me, too. I heard, I think it was an NBC stat saying one in three voters of color went for Donald Trump. I was surprised by that. And in particular, I also heard that Latino men went for Trump 54-44. They had backed Joe Biden in much bigger numbers in 2020. What happened with the support of people of color for the Democratic Party.
And again, I'm not, again, with a caveat about the polling, but my suspicion is, you know, part of what happened is that, especially if you lump all people of color into the same, I think breaking them down in terms of Black, Latino, and Asian, I think the penetration into the Latino community was quite substantial. But Latinos do, in fact, they're not monolithic, and many of them have voted Republican in the past, and it is a, you know, especially look at a place like Texas or Florida, lots of Latinos vote Republican. So in that sense, that's not unusual. I think, again, the big one would be, you know, if there really are significant changes in the number of Blacks, for example, who vote, you know, for vote Republican, and that sort of, you know, and that can't be offset, for example, by the number of Black women who may show up, but they would have to show up in much larger numbers than usual to try to offset that sort of shift that some Black males will have. And it could be significant in a place like Pennsylvania, where you're looking at that or those urban centers being so crucial. But I think when you look at this election overall, to me, what really stands out is there was a lot of speculation about whether white women would defect and, you know, whether abortion rights, for example, reproductive choice would be that those kinds of issues or the sort of concerns about democracy would be an issue that lots of white women would either openly decide to vote for Donald Trump or at least do it in secret. The Harris campaign ran ads trying to, you know, encourage women in general, but especially white women, to defect, to not vote the way their husbands or boyfriends or spouses. Some people thought it was sexist to talk that way. Others thought that it made a lot of sense around the issue of reproductive rights and the pressure women may be getting from their spouses. But I think at the end of the day, that defection did not occur. And in fact, there was strong support. And white women have been strong supporters of the Republican Party going back decades. And so the Democratic Party faces the problem of they haven't won a majority of the white vote since 1964. And it's been difficult to do. And when people of color have been particularly important to the election outcome, it's really because white voters have been evenly split roughly between the two major parties. But when we're seeing such a pivot towards Republicans, even that vote of people of color becomes less of a sort of, you know, a swing, you know, in any direction to the Democratic Party, because it's hard to overcome, especially when so many white males have abandoned the Democratic Party and are voting with the Republicans. And also so many young males who might not have been attached in the past are entering the electorate just to vote for a Donald Trump type figure.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, it would seem that voters of color were not swayed by Kamala Harris's historic candidacy. She didn't play that up so much. And I guess in the final days of the campaign, it was more about attacking Donald Trump and trying to get the message out to voters why she felt that he would be a dangerous president. I don't know. Did she underplay it too much?
Yeah. I mean, she underplayed it. And for reasons that I think at one level are quite understandable. But also part of the challenge, of course, is that Hillary Clinton had lost a race where she emphasized gender a bit more and the historic nature of her race. And I imagine, you know, the conversations that went on inside of the campaign was about how much do you want to sort of refer to gender or the historic nature of the race, but to really run on the issues, to talk about, you know, what you would do to improve the economic situations, the threat to democracy, and the belief that those were the kind, and reproductive rights, the belief that those were the kinds of issues that might resonate more with voters, especially a women voter who know she's a woman. People know she's a woman and she's on the ticket. And so the question is, you know, what do you do to sort of pull people in when they feel the pressures from inflation and the economy, when they are really bothered by immigration and believe the country is just on the wrong course. And so I think that was where the emphasis was at. On the other hand, you know, Donald Trump, you know, dug in deep on what I think were some of the core themes that really resonated. I mean, you know, in many ways, if I had to define the campaign, it was really about saying to his voters, This is a white, Christian, patriarchal, and heterosexual society. And so many things he did and said and talked about, I think, communicated that either in dog whistles or just, you know, blatant language. And I think that worked with a lot of his voters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So much more to ask you about. I want to I want to get your thoughts on what you thought of his speech and about what Kamala Harris might say today, maybe what she should say today. And it's so interesting that she underplayed being a woman, because you would think in this day and age it would be no big deal that a woman is running for president. Right. And yet we have not had a woman president. Don't get me started. Anyhow,
but to be honest, Bridget, I really believe that with these two losses, we may be looking at another generation before this country is ready for a woman to get elected. It is astonishing, because these were two really accomplished women who could do the job. There's no doubt about it. But the nation wasn't ready for it, which is just amazing to me.
And we are back on WICC with a closer look at the election. And Dr. Bilal Siku is back with us. He is an associate professor of political science at the University of Hartford. We touched a little bit upon some of the issues, and it would seem that it came down once again to the economy. And I suppose the Democrats had hoped that the issue of abortion would outweigh that.
Yeah, I think so. And it was just also interesting. I think last night I heard, they talked about exit poll interviews were also suggesting the threat to democracy was a worry that people had. And I think what was interesting about that is that the assumption is that only the Democrats have worries about that. There are lots of Republicans who worried about Kamala Harris being elected and what that would mean for democracy as well. So that played out as well. But I think ultimately, the economy was a big issue, and inflation was certainly a big issue, I think. Especially when you asked the question earlier about males who voted for Trump, I think, there is this sense among especially a lot of younger males that they are falling behind, that women are pushing ahead, and that there's this perception that, this sort of gender gap is occurring. And, a candidate like Donald Trump has been really appealing to them. You know, the other thing that struck me about last night is that there was no red wave in Connecticut. I mean, you look around the country, you see this kind of red wave, and yet, Chris Murphy wins re-election. All of the sort of members of the House win re-election. In fact, Johanna Hayes, who her last race, about 2,000 votes, my understanding the last time I looked, was that she may have won this thing with more than 20,000 votes. And so her vote totals actually increased, this particular race. Republicans didn't make real gains in the House or the Senate. I mean, so that wave didn't happen. Connecticut's a solidly blue state.
Yeah. and yet some other states, namely New York and New Jersey, still solidly blue. But I've been reading that Kamala Harris's, she won by much less than Joe Biden did in both New York State and New Jersey. Yeah. So that will have people now, Monday morning quarterbacking, right? And saying, Joe Biden, he always said, I'm the only guy who can beat Donald Trump. I'm the only one. I can do it. And, well, we know how that turned out. Will Democrats be, I guess, sort of opening that old wound and thinking, geez, maybe he shouldn't have been asked to step aside? Or if he had, perhaps there should have been some sort of a primary season to really see who the strongest candidate would be to go up against Donald Trump?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also important to remember she had 108 days to try to put this together, right, which is not a lot of time in our presidential sort of cycle, which can be up to 2 years when you really think about it. Sometimes people will declare their intentions shortly after the president gets elected, and takes the oath of office. And so there wasn't really a huge window for her to get the name recognition, to really get out there so people could get to know her, really know her, know where she stands. And of course, I think you're right. People will talk about Joe Biden maybe taking too long to drop out, that they could have had a process where they vetted people, had debates among different candidates and maybe emerge with someone who was quite different. And so I think in many ways, when he pulled out so late, it really forced their hand. I think it would have been a real problem if they had jumped over her, especially for a core part of their base, which is women of color, especially black women, who would have wondered aloud about why they jumped over the woman of color to maybe nominate a white male to be the candidate. So, but I think they're going to look at this and they're going to try to figure this out in terms of what happened, you know, and certainly a lot of the, you know, discussion will be around the economy and the economic message that the Democrats have. But I also think that there are some other, you know, trends that are occurring, especially with the way so many white males are drifting away from the party and also males of color. I don't think that's all just about economics. I think there are issues around sexism and also other sort of issues that are out there as well. I think, you know, issues of race, I've been making the argument that, you know, one of the challenges of this era is that, you know, the Democratic Party has really been pushing a message of creating an inclusive and multiracial society, and much of their base is comprised of that. And there are a lot of Americans who, unfortunately, are not really interested in that kind of a future. Mm-hmm. And so to some extent, you know, make America great again and take America back again is not about creating or recreating a multiracial and inclusive society. It's about creating something else.
We only have a minute left. I'm wondering, in Donald Trump's speech, he did talk about unity. Did you notice any language like that we can be hopeful that he will want the nation to come together and try to effort that?
I mean, ultimately, all presidents, you know, offer that kind of message. I mean, if they didn't offer that kind of message, we would find it odd. I think the real question will be, will they take, for example, Project 2025 and that playbook, and will that become the governing document for the party going forward? If that is the case, I think it's going to deepen the divisions that are in our society, because there are some things in there that a lot of people are going to find objectionable. There are some things a lot of people are going to really like inside of that document. And so what's to be seen is what actually will be the concrete policy agenda of a second Trump administration. Who are the people he will appoint to his administration? You know, given, you know, the Never Trumpers and some of the other sort of folks who have not worked and will not work with this administration, it will be interesting to see who those appointments are.
Dr. Bilal Sekou, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Hartford. Doctor, we thank you so much for your insights throughout this campaign season. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Let's turn to a local issue, and that is crime. And joining us is Sergeant Luke Davis. He is with the Connecticut State Police. Crime on the minds of many people during this election season, and now a 136-page report was recently compiled by the Connecticut State Police Crimes Analysis Unit. Sergeant, welcome to the program. Glad to have you here.
Yeah, good afternoon, Bridget. Thank you for having me.
Good afternoon. So basically, you take data from all over Connecticut, yes?
Yeah. So what we're looking at here in terms of this 136-page report is a compilation of data that's being collected from local police departments as well as state police towns that are covered within our jurisdiction. And that also includes tribal territories as well. So the Mashantucket, Pequots, Mohegan tribes are also included within that data.
Gotcha. So really a picture of crime in Connecticut as a whole. Let's break it down, if you would. You looked at crimes against persons. What are those crimes?
So the classifications, as it breaks it down, to give you a glimpse at it. So crimes against persons are things where people in particular are the victim. So that would include the very violent, most extreme cases, such as murder, non-negligent manslaughter, kidnapping, assault, sexual assault offenses, human trafficking.
Okay. And among those crimes that you mentioned, what might be the most commonly committed crime in Connecticut?
So a lot of what we're seeing there are the assault-based offenses. So that in particular is coming out with what we're seeing in terms of domestic violence incidents being the more common. We also see a lot of that in violent cases within the cities where we're dealing with gang-related activity. It is good to mention, at least at this point in time, that there is a slight decrease in crimes against persons. So we're looking at just under 4% decrease from the last data year.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Right. So the crimes against persons down. Do you know why?
So that's actually a very good question. I think part of that may be in turn to more proactive enforcement and programs that are available to people who may be subject to an arrest for such offenses, I think may be showing a little bit of a turn. But the most concerning part of this that we're seeing is the huge uptake in crime against property.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about that now. That looks to be, looking at the synopsis of the report, up 11%. Is that correct?
Yeah. So that's showing an overall increase of 11%.
Is that from 2023 or 2022?
So it has to be a total picture of the year itself. So
right.
This report is actually reflective of data from last year, 2023.
Okay, got you. So up 11%. Property crimes. Who are the victims in these crimes?
The majority of the victims that we're seeing in crimes against property are actually individual people. So it is reflective of other things such as business entities, commercial properties, et cetera. But it's mostly individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So with that raise in 11%, one of the largest proponents of that is actually motor vehicle theft.
Oh,
so the total number, there's actually been over 8,600 automobiles stolen within the state of Connecticut during this year where this data was observed.
Wow. Well, you know, we certainly report on that a lot. Any indication as to why more motor vehicles have been stolen?
One of the most alarming statistics that I observed from reading this myself is of the cases where arrests have been made for motor vehicle thefts, approximately 45% of the arrests made were actually juveniles.
Hmm. Wow. And do we know why that's happening?
So I think a part of the rise in those crimes has actually been spurring towards the state legislature in attempting to make more stringent penalties for juveniles that are committing these crimes because
mm-hmm.
of the fact that it was happening so frequently and that we in law enforcement were seeing it so regularly that something more needed to be done in this regard. So just to give you an inside glimpse of this. So when
sure.
it comes to dealing with a juvenile for us, if we're arresting a juvenile for what would be considered a delinquent act due to their age, we can make an in-custody arrest. However, a juvenile cannot be held on bond as an adult would be. So we could make an arrest, transport the person back to a state police barracks, and hold them in custody, but upon the arrival of a parent or guardian, we have to release them to that guardian. And the arrest itself is a summons where they are issued the summons to appear in juvenile court. So it's not the same kind of balance as you would for an adult where they would be subject to having to pay bail to be released on their own recognizance until such time they appear in court.
And so essentially they're free to go and do it again.
Yeah, it certainly is a possibility. Mm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Do you have stats on how much property has been stolen over the course of the year and how much is able to be recovered?
Yeah, let me get to that here so I can give you a full breakdown.
Okay. In the meantime, just back to the motor vehicle thefts. Yeah, it would seem that if you're let out with a quote unquote slap on the wrist or just given a summons, then that could be problematic. And, you know, as I say, we do hear about that a lot lately in Connecticut. And I wonder, too, if the people who are committing those crimes, you know, when I lived in New York, there was a time when there was a ring going around trying to break into cars just to steal the cars just for their parts. That's all they wanted. Is that what's going on here? Is there some of that, or is it a matter of the thieves actually want the cars?
It's both, actually. So I made mention to the number of vehicles stolen because it is such an alarmingly high figure. But that is also a proponent in this report that gets into detail about auto part theft. And as well, a new category that was added for this were incidents of carjacking. So that's an incident where a vehicle is stolen from somebody's possession while they are in possession of the car, either driving it or within close proximity, like getting gas, for example, where somebody is taking the vehicle from that person.
Right, right. Now, what, if anything, can be done to bring those numbers down, in particular the motor vehicle thefts and carjackings that we've been talking about?
Sure. So we've already been taking proactive measures to kind of reduce these incidents from happening. So earlier this year, for example, we actually saw a huge rash of the carjacking incidents that were actually taking place at highway rest areas off the Merritt Parkway, off of I-95 in the southwest corner of the state. So that area is patrolled by Troop G in Bridgeport. So Troop G was very proactive in doubling down on their efforts, basically, and putting an additional patrol at these rest areas to combat this so that there was a consistent law enforcement presence and it was dissuading that type of behavior from occurring. In addition to that, we do have a lot of involvement with multidisciplinary task force. And when I say multidisciplinary, I mean not just state police, but working in conjunction with our local partners, additional state partners, and even federal law enforcement partners with combating these issues that are going on within the inner cities in Connecticut.
And we are back on Newsline with Sergeant Luke Davis, and we've been parsing a 136-page report recently compiled by the Connecticut State Police Crimes Analysis Unit. And, well, the good news is that crimes against persons were down. The bad news, I guess, property crimes up, in particular motor vehicle thefts. And, Sergeant, just before the break, we were talking a little bit about what's being done on your end to combat those thefts. And what can we, the car owners, do to make sure that we don't get into the situation in the first place?
Well, I think one of the most important things is just to be aware of surroundings. So I think it's smart for people to have completely undivided attention when they are engaging in activities such as getting gas, or pulling into a store and walking away from their vehicle. So first and foremost, anytime you get out of the vehicle, do not leave it running and do not leave it unsecured. So even if it's a quick stop into a convenience store to grab a drink or a snack or whatever have you, it's still a smart idea to shut your car down, lock it, and take your keys with you. Same thing applies at the pumps. It's best to use pumps that are well lit, closer to the building, the better. For advantage of having surveillance actually showing over that pump, and also keeping the head on the swivel and paying attention to the things going on around you.
Yeah, always good advice. It still astonishes me when I hear, and maybe it's partly because I did live a number of years in New York, including years living in the big city, but in a million years, I wouldn't leave my keys in the car. I just don't get it. But anyhow, let's talk about another aspect of this report that I thought was really interesting, fraud. And it seems that more fraud involves cybercrime. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Mm. Absolutely. So this report is actually showing that individual incidents, so cases where individual people are the victims of a fraud offense, is well over 14,000. So that's over 93% of the total figures for fraud offenses for the year 2023 is an individual person who was a victim.
Wow. And these targeting of older Connecticut residents, right? But like 55 and up, is it just because they're just not aware? Does it happen because they're not aware? They don't hear about this and they don't realize that they're being scammed?
That is a large proponent of it. Yeah. So what's interesting about these figures is that over 31% of the offenses actually are occurring in cyberspace. So it's through means of using the internet. So of that 31%, that's actually a 47% increase from 2022 figures.
And wow, overall, that's huge, right?
It very much so,
wow.
Yeah. That's okay. Actually over 136% increase from 2021.
Wait, oh boy. So what's going on? The cyber criminals are just getting more adept and more prolific?
Yeah, so these are very, very involved investigations. And we are seeing a large number of the victims are more in the senior citizen bracket. So we're looking at over 35% of the victims of these frauds that are falling within that category of 55 and up. So it's really a matter of impressing upon everybody, for that fact, within our population in the state, to educate and let people know about the hazards and dangers that are out there in terms of people trying to take advantage of them. So we have very skilled detectives that work for the Connecticut State Police who specialize in these cybercrime investigations. And they are very proactive in the messaging that we put out there so that people are advancing with caution with anything that they do in terms of using the internet.
Right. And again, as with, preventing the crimes or preventing older people from becoming victims of crime, similarly to making sure your car doesn't get stolen, what can we do, Sergeant? If you have an older loved one, an older friend or neighbor, what can you do to clue them in to the fact that this is going on and that, wow, these numbers are up 47%?
Sure. Well, I think one of the biggest things to keep in mind is many people in our population that are up there in age, this is not something that they've dealt with their whole life. So it may be a new thing for many people in our population in working with the internet and doing things online. So I think it's very important for family, friends to sit down and help educate their loved ones in what it is that they should be looking out for, and to not trust anything that seems too good to be true. Because as the old saying goes, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
And that is certainly true. And one last topic that I read about in this report was drugs seized in the state of Connecticut, primarily cocaine?
Yeah. There actually has been a large spike in that we've seen recently, but as has been an issue for the past several years, we are still combating the opioid epidemic that we're seeing here. So it's a combination of heroin as well as synthetic based fentanyl that is very, very dangerous for anybody.
Right. Before we go, any other highlights or lowlights, I guess, from this report that I might have missed, Sergeant?
So I think the most important things to take into account from reviewing this is we do have some wins on our side. So as we discussed, the crimes against persons being down, crimes against society are down as well. Not as much. I mean, that's just over a 2% decrease. But the crimes against society also include those narcotics-based cases. So it is showing that there is some improvement with the work that we're doing in trying to combat these issues. So even if it may be a small win, I say we take it when we have the opportunity.
It's still a win. All right. Well, listen, we thank you so much for telling us all about this. It is much appreciated. Sergeant Luke Davis with the Connecticut State Police. Sergeant, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.